The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. Ahead on today's episode, we get to grips with this week's new theatre openings in London with the critic Matt Wolfe, and we'll be leafing through some new book releases with John Mitchinson, publisher at Unbound. Plus, we'll head to a new exhibition in Dublin that assesses our relationship with authenticity and all things fake, and we'll have some Latin American music in this week's Global Countdown with Fernando. That's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Do stay tuned. Matt and John, welcome to the Arts Review. We will start with theatre, and this month we find not one, not two, but four, count them, productions of Macbeth hitting theatres in London. A tragedy of Macbeth's, in fact. One of these, possibly at the risk of tipping the general tone of the critical assessments, is Rufus Norris's staging of it at the National Theatre, starring Anne-Marie Duff and Rory Kinnear as the doomed lead couple. First of all, Matt, Is it unusual that everybody decides to do the same Shakespeare play at the same time?
Well, sometimes if you do a little bit of research, it seems that it's a set text for that year, and somebody somehow knows that. And all of a sudden, Twelfth Night is ubiquitous. I do remember one year, and I don't think this has been equaled, Andrew, when there were five productions of The Tempest. So at least this, we have one more to go before we get to that.
Well, let's not tempt fate, and let's look at this particular staging of it, Rufus Norris's. The reviews in general have been, let's be charitable and call them ordinary. Is that fair?
Well, I come slightly to defend a production that I have to say I thought was going to generate this sort of response. From the very beginning that the play was announced, there was a lot of stick about, well, what does Rufus Norris know about Shakespeare? He's not Peter Hall, Trevor Nunn, some of these Shakespearean greats. He did one Shakespeare play, which in fact I think was The Tempest, 20-odd years ago. He's never directed Shakespeare at the National. As if this was somehow something with which he should be shamed. And I thought, well, actually quite useful to bring a newcomer's perspective
Obviously. To
somebody whose stuff can look pretty pro forma. And what I responded to about this production, for all of its eccentricities and its weirdnesses, is that it does, for good or for ill, feel fresh. There's nothing routine about it. He has thought it through moment to moment, but I think the results are probably not what, certainly not what the purists want. And I think because both the leading actors, Rory Kinnear and Anne-Marie Duff, are such proven classical actors, there's a disconnect between his inexperience and their experience, and so people are having trouble making it all come together.
I mean, Shakespeare purists, like purists of most things, tend to be terrifically tedious people.
Yeah.
Is it just the purists who are getting upset about this, or are there, basically what I'm asking is, the people who have disliked this play, what are they disliking
about
it?
Well, here's one thing I find very peculiar. One of the prevailing criticisms I've seen so far is that Macbeth, as we all know, is called the Scottish play, especially when we're not allowed to say the name, and I don't have any truck with that sort of superstition. So some of the critics have said this is insufficiently Scottish, this production. Now, I have probably seen in my life 20 or 30 Macbeths. I can't remember any that were dyed-in-the-wool Scots with burrs and kilts and whatever. So I'm not quite sure what, you know, this production is supposed to be. It's not a documentary of Scotland, thank heavens. What I like about it is that it has this wild Mad Max inflected vision that it submits to wholeheartedly. And if you go with that, you go with it. Of course, if you resist it, there's nothing that the production can do to win you over, because that's the landscape of the play from the minute it starts.
John, are you a regular theatre goer? And if so, would you go to see four Macbeths in one season?
That's a great question. I've got a kid who's doing GCSE English, where it is indeed a set text.
That explains
it. We have had a conversation only last night to say we should go and see at least one of them with Rory, our 16-year-old. I don't go to enough theatre. I would love. It's one of the things. In fact, Matt, you inspired me last time. It's one of my on my kind of to-do list this year to go and see more. We live just down the road from Stratford as well. It's kind of shameful that we don't go more often.
Well, one of the Macbeths coming up has yet to open is one in Stratford, which this one will be inevitably compared to most acutely, because that one also has a radical director, Polly Findlay. Yeah. It's got two well-known leads, Christopher Eccleston, ex-Doctor Who, and Niamh Cusack. So I don't think that's going to be conventional.
I was going to say, looks pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as you were saying earlier, Matt, you've seen a great many Macbeths. What is the gulf between the best and the worst? And where does this production fit in?
You know, the problem
on that spectrum.
I think there's an inbuilt problem with Macbeth now, which is that it's steeped in an element of superstition that we in our secular, godless age, or however you want to describe it, don't really submit to. So the fact that this is a play that begins with three witches, that's automatically a problem. How do you present them? And a lot of people have resisted the way they're presented here, which is very strange, abstract, kind of crazed. There's a rave element to this, so you feel as if the whole thing is some sort of falling down the Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole into a landscape that is certainly more Shoreditch rave than Scotland. But I think there's a landscape to the play that we don't know how to interpret. The best version I've ever seen of the witches was one where you never saw them, you just heard them. And I think that's the cleverest way to do it, because as soon as they're represented, you go, nah, that doesn't do it.
John, would you prefer to see a Macbeth that was all sort of like kilts and castles and that sort of thing, or are you more open to more radical interpretations?
I'm always open to radical interpretations. I mean, we kind of my generation, we were brought up on Jan Kott, Shakespeare,
yeah,
our
absolutely.
Contemporary. So, in fact, I always feel slightly cheated when I saw the Michael Fassbender film, which was kind of all right.
But yeah,
I mean,
okay. Look,
what you sort of want with Shakespeare, I think, is to mine. It seems to me the whole point of Shakespeare is to reinvent, to take the kind of the elemental human truths of the plays and to represent them in a way that makes them contemporary. Otherwise, it's just kind of it's National Trust. It's not art anymore.
I couldn't agree more with that. And it's interesting you mentioned having a son called Rory, because I don't think there is a better Shakespearean, and this is going out on a limb, but I really don't think there's a better Shakespearean now than Rory Kinnear, because he's played Hamlet in this same theater, he's played Iago in this same theater, and he just has that incredible quality of making intelligence something alive and febrile. You can feel it, and yet it's absolutely of the moment. It's spontaneous. There's nothing canned about it. There's nothing set text. He's discovering it in the moment, and that's not easy.
So just as a final thought, I guess, on this one, Rufus Norris's production at the National, are you going to swim against the general critical tide on this and suggest people go and see it? If you're going to see one of four Macbeths this season?
I haven't seen the other three, so that's not quite a fair assessment to make yet. What I would say is if you can rid yourself of pre-existing bias, give it a go, and certainly with Rory Kinnear, you will not be disappointed in him.
Are you tempted, John?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rory Kinnear and Anne-Marie Duff are such great. I mean, you'd be tempted just to see them in anything. So, have I more to learn from Macbeth? Almost certainly. That's the great thing about Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, that Macbeth is on at the National Theatre until the 23rd of June. You can check your local listings magazines for the other plethora of Macbeth. So, is it Macbeths or Macbeth?
Probably.
It sounds like one of those counterintuitive plurals. It is touring the UK from September onwards. We'll look now at a lesser-known play by another classic playwright, in this instance Tennessee Williams. The play is Summer and Smoke, which is currently playing at the Almeida Theatre in Islington. Matt, as it is a lesser-known play by Tennessee Williams, which is to say, I think for most people, it isn't A Streetcar Named Desire.
Right.
What is the basic premise of this one?
It's very Tennessee Williams-y in its premise, which is basically thwarted love. In this case, small-town middle America, and you've got a preacher's daughter who falls in love, probably ill-advisedly, with the doctor's son, next door from which not much good happens.
Isn't Preacher's Daughters falling ill-advisedly in love the plot of every Tennessee Williams play? Or am I generalizing?
I don't know that they're always Preacher's Daughters, Andrew, but there's a lot of ill-advised love, that's for sure. And the place names in Tennessee Williams are always so ridiculously ironic. I mean, in Streetcar Named Desire, there's talk about Belle Reve. In this, it's Glorious Hill, so that inglorious things can then happen. What's interesting about this production, just as a piece of staging, is that, funnily enough, it's cut from exactly the same cloth as Macbeth, in that it throws out the rule book. For one thing, this is, I think, possibly the only Tennessee Williams production I've ever seen that has no set at all, aside, and certainly nothing representational. What you see on stage when you walk in is a crescent of 9 pianos. This is not in Tennessee Williams' stage direction.
I would be surprised.
And then a little sunken, kind of planked playing area where most of the play plays itself out. So there are no distractions. The pianos are played now and again by members of the very diligent cast, and that allows music to act as counterpoint or complement to what's happening. And it also means there's no decor to distract you. It's all about the psychology.
Why is this a lesser known Tennessee Williams play? It sank more or less without trace when it premiered on Broadway in 1948.
It did, although like a lot of Williams and a lot of great American dramatists, it had a resurgence off-Broadway a couple of years later, and then it sort of shimmied its way into the canon. But, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and Glass Menagerie for Williams set the bar very high. This is a play that he has worked and reworked, a little bit like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, but not as successfully. And I think people feel that it's kind of betwixt and between. What this production does very well is sort of banish associations to other plays. You don't feel like you're watching a Williams also-ran, which I think is the danger with this kind of thing. Instead, you really feel like it's very forensic. You feel like you're peering right into the psychology of a woman who is really struggling to keep it together. Because there's nothing else really to look at on the stage except the remarkable Patsy Farron, you're very aware of just how dangerous a tightrope she's walking moment to moment.
So you're talking about the lack of any stage set apart from this crescent of 9 pianos,
yeah.
Which, if I've done the maths right, is more than twice the number of productions of Macbeth. currently underway. These are going to become new units of measurement.
It's a numerological theater reviewing here.
Exactly. Yeah. How many Macbeths make up a... Anyway, but do they use that as means to drag the production sort of kicking and screaming into the here and now? Or is it in the way that a lot of Tennessee Williams stuff is played as a period piece?
It's sort of played out of time. And I think what they want to do, and it works very well... And a lot of the same critics who sniffed about Macbeth have raved about this, so, you know, go figure, is they're treating it as a tone poem. The play is basically analyzing a state of mind. And what the music does is amplify that. It doesn't really matter if it's set in America or not. They happen to do, and I say this as an American, they happen to do, the cast in general, some of the best American accents I've heard on the British stage in a long time. But it's actually, it could be set anywhere and about anyone who has experienced these very primal feelings that these characters are going through. The other thing that the production has very dramatically is a real sense of danger. You sometimes feel with Tennessee Williams, there's a kind of delicacy and languor, and it's not quite sure what's underpinning that. In this, it's actually quite raw, and you feel at any minute as if both the leading characters, the doctor's son and the preacher's daughter, could go off the deep end.
Well, the accents thing in itself, I think, is genuinely high praise. I have unenjoyed several things when somebody's tried to do an Australian accent and not quite got it right. And
I'm sure.
One of my happiest cinema-going memories was going to see the film Michael Collins when it opened, and I happened to be in Dublin at the time, and it was obviously quite a big deal that this, you know, they'd made a film of this great Revolutionary War hero. Every time Julia Roberts opened her mouth in that film, the entire cinema absolutely erupted.
Started to roar. Yeah,
absolutely gales of laughter, which rather undermined the dramatic import of what was going on the screen. Johnny, are you tempted by a production of Tennessee Williams set amid a crescent of pianos?
I'm kind of intrigued. I mean, I don't know the play. So,
I think you'd like it, John.
I mean, new Tennessee Williams. You've got to say, you know, if you. I mean, I'm kind of a sucker for his work. So, I think it's interesting what you say about the music. The idea that there is, I think that's one of the reasons for wanting to reconnect with theatre a bit. I like a lot of people, I went to a lot and then I got bored.
Yeah.
And I haven't reconnected. But yeah. I mean, I definitely go and see something. I think I don't want to go and see straight theatre. This sounds like an imaginative and interesting way of doing it.
There was in fact a production of this play 10, 11 years ago, something like that, on the West End with Rosamund Pike, who's now, you know, a bit of a movie star, but she wasn't then. And that was a production that was exactly literal-minded by the book and, in fact, closed 6-7 weeks early. Whereas what's interesting about this, the young actress Patsy Farron, who plays Alma, the main character, whose name is Spanish for soul, as the play tells us several times over. And this is a very nice thing that happens in the theater. I mean, it happens in every discipline, but it's nice when you see it live in front of you. She's a young actress, 20-something, and she's been sort of climbing the ladder. And this is the biggest role she's been given. And it's just wonderful to see her seize it. And last night at the press night, there was an instant standing ovation, which is pretty rare for non-musicals. And it seemed to be a sign that she had arrived. And that was very touching.
Okay, well, Summer and Smoke is on at the Alameda until the 7th of April. Thanks for all that, Matt. John, we'll turn to you now to talk books. And to get us in the mood, we will start with one that celebrates the joy of reading, especially reading when young. This is Bookworm. It's a memoir of childhood reading. It's a new one by Lucy Mangan. It's both a memoir and not. It's a memoir of her experience of children's literature and a study of children's literature, correct?
That's perfect, yeah. I mean, what she does is she tells the story. Basically, her early life was completely defined. She says it early on in the book. Her early life was defined by reading. And what she gives you, in a way, is a kind of an autobiography. There's a lot of stuff in here about her mother and father and her sister. But it's all through the prism of what she's reading at the time. Right from the very beginning, her father, who was a kind of a stay-at-home dad, her mum was a kind of a stage manager at the National and very, very hardworking. So she had a kind of inverted childhood. Lucy is brilliant about the humour in the book is what kind of keeps it going. She read everything. She was voracious. She had her favourites. And the book, in a way, is a settling of scores as much as anything else. She's going through the books. She defends. There's a whole chapter on Enid Blyton where she kind of vigorously defends Enid Blyton against her detractors. She still never read a book by Dickens. She couldn't get on with Tolkien. It's again, one of the joys for me is the unexpected. A lot of the books I had read, I was a bookish child as well. But reading for her, she says rather wonderfully towards the end of the book, I mean, maybe just read you it, because it kind of captures the tone of the book perfectly. She says that reading, people say that life's the thing, but I prefer reading, which is a quote. Yes, I have thought in my weaker moments, but you really do need to live some life, don't you? But then I come back to myself and think, No, I don't. I've lived so many lives through books, gone to so many places, so many eras, looked through so many different eyes, considered so many different points of view. The fact that I haven't had time to do much myself seems but a small price to pay. So it really, this is an extreme defence of reading, as not just as a sort of an addition to life, but as a kind of the main thing that you do with your life.
I mean, Lucy Mangan is a very snappy and very funny writer, as people who've seen her Guardian columns will already be aware. How does she play the book? Is it a sort of more ruminative memoir of childhood and literature, or is it played substantially for laughs?
It's played, I think, substantially for laughs, but every now and then she breaks out into something that's kind of terrible. Rather moving, and the way she deals with her father's cancer, for example, is beautifully done in the book. But she takes it, so you start with Eric Carle and the Very Hungry Caterpillar, and then you go through Sendak, and then she has a ghastly experience. Having read sort of Kate Greenaway picture books, she discovers the Arthur Rackhams, which she cannot look at without feeling... She doesn't want to be taken away on adventures. She wants domesticity, safety. So she's always... That's why the Millie Molly Mandy books are the books that she ends up loving. And it's really it's the growth of a child's mind. I mean, this is now a genre, I think, bibliomemoir. Frances Spufford, The Child That Books Built, there's a wonderful book by Samantha Ellis about reading the Brontes and the effect that... Viv Grosskopf's got a book about Russian fiction out at the moment. My backlisted partner Andy Miller did a book called The Year of Reading Dangerously, where he set himself to read sort of 100 classics. So it's kind of a genre, but I think she does it... I think what people will get from the book, A, they'll get that wonderful... moment of, my God, yes, of course, Tom's Midnight Garden. I haven't thought about that book for years. I must go back and see them out. She's very good on the difference between reading as an adult and reading as a child. The utter absorption, the kind of the almost addictive immersive quality of reading.
Which you do wonder is still the case for people who are being raised in an era of permanent distraction. I mean, the book's interesting to me because the way you describe her describing herself is pretty much what I was like as a kid. I grew up in a house full of books and we were encouraged to read, so I read absolutely everything from a very early age. But I just wonder if that is going to be a common experience.
Well, she has her own ongoing experiment with her son, who I think is 6 years old, called Alexander. And she's trying, obviously, not to force reading onto him, but the house is surrounded by books. She doesn't come to any, I think, earth-shattering conclusions, except that you have to put the books in front of children and see what will happen. My experience has been that all my boys have read books. Teenagers, I think, in general, boys tend to get sort of distracted into other things. But they are all, I think reading is still there as a sort of a viable option for them. I mean, it's interesting, you know, that the statistics seem to suggest that, you know, physical books are at holding their own, and that although e-books have kind of exploded, and quite rightly, it's pretty cool way to be able to carry a lot of books around with you at any given time. But the actual act of reading, the reading of stories and the inhabiting of stories with one's own imagination, which is something you don't get from screen-based entertainment, is not dying. So, I mean, I'm optimistic about it, but then perhaps as a publisher I would be.
I mean, it would be remiss, obviously, at this point, not to ask you both about any particular favourites from your own childhood. I'll start with you, Matt. Did you have a favourite, or I guess a non-canonical children's book you would like to recommend?
Well, I grew up in New York and reading people like E.B. White. Do people read E.B. White in the U.K.? I have no idea.
Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, Charlotte's Web.
Very moving. In fact, there's a spoiler alert for this book. Don't read this book if you haven't read Charlotte's Web or intend to read it.
It's so, listening to your very eloquent description, John, is actually very touching because it reminds me of a time when, you know, books are sort of your friends.
Yeah.
And then when you get older, they become different. They become assignments and homework. And there's a kind of different relationship. And you somehow wish you could retrieve that earlier connection because it's very primal.
Did you have an outsider favourite that you would nominate as a youth?
It's a good question. I'm a huge fan of Alan Garner, not a writer who is mentioned by Lucy. One thing to say about this book is it for me it was great because there's a whole slew of books, Sweet Valley High and Mallory Towers, and that girls read that boys tend to not read. But there's a wonderful book called The Stone Book Quartet by Alan Garner, which is, I think, my favourite. And I read that probably at the right time when I was about 12 or 13.
Just before we move on, I would recommend one of my own from an Australian childhood, which is, it's a book I've since bought many copies of to give to British friends with young children with a certain amount of trepidation, because it does have a happy ending, but like no other children's book I've ever read, man, do you work for it. It's called The Bunyip of Berkeley's Creek by Jenny Wagner. It's beautifully illustrated. It's a children's book, I think, for, you know, 4 to 5 year olds, but it's also an absolutely existentially terrifying fairy tale. It's quite weird. I hadn't realised until I got to the point where I thought this would be a nice present for friends with kids, and read it again for the first time in about 40 years and just started thinking, oh my God, you shouldn't be letting children loose on this. I blame it for a great deal. Bookworm.
There's quite a lot about that in this book as well.
So Bookworm, anyway, a memoir of childhood reading, is out now, published by Penguin. And finally, on the books front, we look at Ordinary People, the latest novel by British author Diana Evans. It follows two couples at a crossroads in their lives. So yes, Ordinary People, two couples at a crossroads. This is going to be a sort of this is a How We Live Now novel, isn't it?
It is a How We Live Now novel, and you know, I have to say, I'm usually looking for something a little bit more than this, but I absolutely love this book. I mean, it's the great thing. It's the great thing about fiction, you know. It is a book about London. The book is a kind of a poem to contemporary London in many ways. And although it's beautifully written, it's in no way flashily written. There are no sort of fictional tricks. There's no experimentalism. There's a faint hint of the supernatural only, but that's as much to do with a woman living in South London, being sort of possessed by a kind of sense of the collapsing of Crystal Palace a century earlier. So it there's no magic realism here. She takes four incredibly beautifully crafted characters, builds them from the bottom up so that you get to know them, you get to trust them, and then takes you through There are, you know, there are no car chases. There's one holiday in Spain. There is a stabbing on the street of one of the couples, of a young teenage boy. I mean, very London, very contemporary. It's set at the time. It's set in 2008, so the time of the Obama election. But what she does is, I mean, it's in a way it's old fashioned, but because, you know, the clue's in the title, ordinary people living ordinary lives, the extraordinariness is the precision, the absolute precision with which she captures their emotional, the shades of emotion, of relationships beginning to fall apart, of what happens to couples when they have children, of that inability to communicate, of the slow kind of breaking down of sexual intimacy. You end up caring very much about these characters. It sounds old-fashioned. It is old-fashioned, but she does it, again, you know, a great writer, and I think she's a really interesting writer.
It is a high-wire act, though, the How We Live Now novel, because obviously I think, on the one hand, you think there's a ready-made audience, because I think people are extraordinarily pleased and flattered to see art made from the time and place in which they live, but because that's your audience, they're the people who are totally going to know if you've got it wrong.
Yes, it is absolutely, that's a very good way of playing it, and it's a high-wire act which she manages, I think, flawlessly. I mean, I can imagine that you could toss the book aside, you know, the room, and say, you know, it's not for me. Fine, you know, great fiction. You can do that with everything. Lucy Mangan has still not read Dickens, foolishly, in my view. But
no, I'm with her on that, and but even more so on Tolkien.
Well, that's another conversation. This is about as far from Tolkien, or indeed from Dickens, actually. But
That should be the quote on the jacket.
It is contemporary London, and it is what she does is she spins a beautifully. At the end of the book, you go back and you know it's been beautifully constructed. And she has made you care about the characters. It's not easy to do that. It's not easy to do that with prose. It's not easy to do it. And the incidental fact that most of the characters, and I say it's an incidental, it's not an incidental fact at all. It's fundamental that these are black families living in contemporary London. She puts all of that into the story. The particular Damien, one of the characters, who the book is really about him coming to terms with the death of his father, who was a black activist from the 1960s, is so beautifully done and so not drawing attention to itself that you feel that the ordinary people. It is like a lot of fiction, I guess, an attempt to try and salvage and to redeem the ordinariness of people's lives by putting them into a framework which sort of makes sense of them. I came into the book pretty neutral. I hadn't read her other two novels, but I'm a huge fan now. I will look out for her books in future.
Well, that sounds a fairly unambiguous recommendation. That's Ordinary People by Diana Evans. It will be published by Chatto and Windus at the beginning of April. John Mitchinson and Matt Wolfe, thanks for talking us through the worlds of books and theatre today. John and Matt will be sticking around for the Global Countdown shortly. But first, we are heading over to Ireland for a new exhibition. Now, when the word fake comes to mind in 2018, it is usually ensued by the word news. However, there is more to fake than fake news. Science Gallery Dublin in Trinity College Dublin has created an exhibition called Fake, that's capital F-A-K-E, that looks at our hunger for the authentic and the many falsities that we bear in our life and possibly in the future. Sebastian Stevenson now gets to the truth of the matter.
Hey there, so my name is Ashlyn Callahan and I'm just a mediator on the exhibition at the moment, so this is my fourth exhibition with the Science Gallery.
One of the things I guess we might find a bit peculiar to talk about in terms of authenticity and fake is this particular exhibition right here. What exactly is it showing here?
So this piece here is called True or False, and it revolves around the idea that depending on how information is presented to us, so what kind of font or typeface is used, for example, this can really affect our perception of how, like, true or false a statement could be or how true or false a story could be. So in 2013, there was a filmmaker called Errol Morris, and he ran a study in the New York Times where he tested 45,000 participants on kind of how much they believed a statement depending on what font or what typeface they used. So he went around to these people with a statement about something about an asteroid crashing into Earth, and he used a different font for each person. So he had six fonts that he rotated with all these participants, and they thought that they were just being tested on, I guess, the likelihood of an asteroid hitting Earth. They didn't actually realize this whole typeface thing behind it. So what he realized after testing these participants was that they were most likely to believe the statement if it was used with the typeface Baskerville, and least likely to believe the statement if it was used with Comic Sans, which I think a lot of people probably could have predicted because it's not really taken that seriously anyway. So here we have a book that we've printed purely in the typeface Baskerville, and we've made it kind of difficult to read on purpose. And the idea is to just kind of start this conversation with the visitors about what kind of implications they think using different fonts can have. For example, if you were to read a story online, like say Facebook or Twitter, and it was using a specific font, are you more likely to believe it? Is that a way that you can actually spread false information and get a large amount of people to actually believe the false information? So it kind of falls back on the whole fake news thing that people are talking about quite a lot. So yeah.
We've been hearing a lot of bird chirping, right? Why is there bird chirping? Isn't that the most natural thing in the world? Why do we have bird chirping in an exhibition about fakeness?
So that's the interesting thing. I don't know if people would be surprised to know this, but there's actually a lot of, I guess, fakeness in the animal kingdom itself. So there's hundreds of examples of animals either mimicking sounds, mimicking other animals in terms of how they look or how they sound. You know, you see examples of camouflage and basically just animals pretending to be what they're not in order to gain some kind of advantage over another animal or for some evolutionary reason or another. So here with this piece, the artists have actually recorded these noises that have been just generated by different, I guess, software they have on their computers at random. So each series of chirps is different, so it's not in a cycle. They'll be different kind of each time you hear them periodically. So the idea here is that starlings in nature will often mimic the noises of what they hear in their own natural environment. So kind of, I suppose you could think of them as like almost parroting the sounds of other birds. But interestingly enough, when starlings are found in like urban situations and in like neighborhoods, you'll actually hear them imitating artificial noises that are created by humans, like car alarms and things like that. So I guess inspiration behind this piece was that I know that the artists used to hear them in their own neighborhood, and they used to hear them mimicking particularly like car alarms near like an auto garage near their house. So they've created the sounds here themselves that are meant to kind of like represent what they used to hear in their own neighborhood. So it's pretty interesting to think about, yeah.
The exhibition has two reoccurring themes in it, food and media. Aisling Murray, the producer of the exhibition, yes, that's two different Aislings, spoke to me about how media is an important aspect of the relationship between the authentic and the fake.
I think we try and see things as being black and white, but actually they've always been blurred, and it's very much about context. So, you know, fake news, which is one of the things that we obviously explore in this theme, under this theme also, is something that it feels like people maybe only think has come about in the past 2-3 years, or it's certainly much more prevalent in the news. But one of the pieces we have in the exhibition is from a newspaper from like 60 years ago, where the front page, there's notes to the editor to draw in little helmets behind, there was a strike, so to draw in workers' helmets to make it look like there was far more people at this strike than there were at this strike than there were. So I suppose again, it's kind of questioning that whenever there's new media, things that will be adapted, and also it's about the context in which it's presented, and to maybe not accept things so readily, to consider more the context around them and the way that it's presented to you, and which goes for some of the hoaxes that we are presenting within the exhibition as well. So you know, this exhibition is called Fake, so people aren't going to come in and be fooled that something in here is real, which was a really interesting conversation we had, because there was pieces that we wanted to put in, but we were like, well, why would we put this in when people are coming to an exhibition called Fake? They're not going to be fooled, and that story isn't as compelling in this context then. But what the pieces that we do have that are around forgeries or fakes or hoaxes, and we're trying to explore more of those layers around why it is that people believe these things in the first place, and it's often to do with the context in which they're presented to the public or to the visitors.
And in the context of the science gallery, the authentic and the fake are presented not as opposites, but as a continuum. It shows the many layers of falsities and realities that are woven into our world. Fake runs till the 3rd of June. For Monocle in Dublin, I'm Sebastian Stevenson.
Thanks to Sebastian for that report. Now, as always on the Arts Review, to end today's show, we have this week's Global Countdown. And joining me, John and Matt, in the studio is Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, first of all, where are you taking us today?
Well, taking us to South America, to Colombia, which I think is the first time I'm doing Colombia. And I have to say, the very strong music market in the region. I think after Puerto Rico, Colombia is one of the main stars in Latin America when it comes to music. And it's a good top five. I hope you like it, Andrew. Shall we start at number five?
Yes,
then?
Please, let's do start at number five. Introduce, if you would, the artist.
Yes, let's play a clip. This is Gracie with Más Fuerte.
At the risk of stereotyping a nation and indeed an entire continent, that is literally exactly what I would have imagined the number five single in the Columbia Hit Parade in a given week to have sounded like.
And can I tell you something about Gracie, actually? It's a very easygoing pop, you know, but she's more famous as being as a soap opera actress. Can it be more
clever? You astound me. Absolutely astound me.
So I think that's her second single, actually. So she worked in a lot of soap opera. She was a very popular actress there in Colombia. And then she's back, actually, at number four. That was the first single, which is still actually, you know, on top of the second single as well. But this time she's doing a partnership with her boyfriend or husband. I have to double check on that. But his name is Mike Bahia. You know, he's a Colombian musician. And he tattooed her face on his leg.
I would find that weird. I mean, I'm not saying I would find it weird if he tattooed my face on his leg, though that would be extremely strange.
That would be even weirder.
That would be even weirder. I would find it kind of weird if anybody did that.
It's kind of intense and Colombian thing to do, isn't it?
It is very intense, but I'm glad because I did check the tattoo and it does look a little bit like her. At least it was not like a disaster. Because there's a lot of...
What if they split up?
It's
definitely not something you reveal on the second date, is it? You'd want to be pretty sure of yourself.
All I can say about the size of the tattoo, if they split up, it would be very painful for him. It's quite a big, large tattoo. And this song is called Amantes, which is lovers. It's a lovely song. Shall we listen to a clip?
Please. Does that translate as this thing cost a fortune and it really hurt, don't ever leave me?
I mean, this couple, a good thing about them, they love public displays of affection. I mean, all the pictures I've seen of them, even the video clip, it's all about love and, yeah.
Very out there.
Mm-hmm. As you can imagine with the tattoo as well.
And is the song basically another public display of affection?
Yes. Even the name, Lovers. We're lovers.
We love each other. And is it accompanied by a thoroughly nauseating video clip as well?
Of course.
obviously.
But she's sweet, Grace. You know? But I wonder if she'll go back to the world of telenovelas now. Well, she's doing very well in the music world.
Has she done the thing which was a career path for generations of my fellow Australians of leveraging fame on soap opera into fame as a pop star?
Very, very. I think that's what she's doing.
She's the Colombian Kylie. Is that what you're trying to say?
She looks a bit like Kylie in a strange way.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. She looks like Kylie in a strange way.
No. Yeah, she does actually look a little bit like Kylie.
Okay.
Okay, how strange are we talking?
No, not strange, because, you know, I don't know, I just can't imagine Kylie when I look at Gracie.
Okay. Is she also at number three?
Number two and one.
Or are other artists allowed in the top five this week?
A bit of change now. No romantic pop now, but it's a little bit of Latin trap music. And we have a clip of Bad Bunny with Amor Foda.
That is a very sad song, Fernando. Has the woman he got tattooed on his leg just left him?
I prefer Gracie, I have to be honest with you.
What do we know of Bad Bunny?
Well, what we know about Bad Bunny, he's from Puerto Rico, and he's doing very, very well, again, all over Latin America. I mean, he's the kind of guy who releases lots of singles, because that's the trend these days. Do you remember in the past when someone released, like, one song, and it was, like, on the charts for about 4 months? But now it's a much...
You're lucky if you're on the charts for 4 minutes.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But he's good, and he does this kind of Latin trap music, which is also quite popular, especially in Colombia, Puerto Rico, Venezuela. I mean, he's a good guy. He's not quite like Gracie, but, you know, I can accept him.
Well, and I'm sure he doesn't mind this week because he's at number 3 and she's having to cope with 4 and 5.
Exactly.
He is on the podium, she is not. At number 2.
Number 2 is someone that everybody knows here is Daddy Yankee, I mean, from the Despacito fame. And to be honest, it's funny because he's 41, but I looked at the video, he looks like 21. I don't know if he had any work done. I don't want to speculate.
perish the thought.
Music and an international best-selling hit keeps you young.
Exactly. I'm sure surgical corrections among South American pop stars are unusual.
Very
unusual. Hardly ever happens.
So rare. So rare.
Very, very, very rare. Daddy
Aging
Yankee,
slowly.
Yes, do go on.
But the song is very nice. It's very Daddy Yankee, very kind of reggaeton. Not a big difference from his previous singles. So I think he likes to keep it safe. Shall we listen to the clip?
Please do.
The song's called Dura.
That falls into that genre, that strange genre of songs I always think of as the song that's playing at deafening volume on the radio on the taxi you get into after a really long flight.
Yeah, I mean, it's number 2. Of course it would be playing there.
Yeah, okay, but not yet at number 1. What is?
Number 1, it's Nicky Jam and J Balvin, which is a Colombian singer, and Nicky Jam is American, Puerto Rican, and the song's called X. It's a very recent song. It's the first week in the chart, a very strong debut. And again, you were talking about reggaeton here, but there's a new trend with a little bit more urban reggaeton. So it's the combination of the Caribbean sounds with more kind of urban music. You will feel it now. Let's hear it to X.
I quite like that one and therefore concur with the choices made by Colombian record purchasers this week.
Infectious beats, no?
That's number
nice.
1.
Yeah.
Is it likely to stay there, or is Colombia like every pop market in the world now, one where you are at number 1 for, yeah, as we were saying, 5 minutes if you're lucky?
I trust the power of J Balvin. I mean, he's a major pop star. I think he will manage to stay another month or two in the top of the charts. What did you guys think of it?
I like sounds great. I mean, I like that. Of all the ones we've heard, I'm concurring with Andrew. I think it was the best. Deserves its number 1 slot.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wish Gracie would be number 1, though.
Well, I think are you taken with Gracie? I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, are these ones she has at number 5 and 4, are they on their way up or on their way down?
Yeah, exactly.
I think the number 5 is on the way up, number 4 on the
so
way down.
So watch this space.
Well, exactly. Maybe I'll come in 2 weeks and see.
She may yet get her chance and another opportunity for a celebratory tattoo for her husband. That does bring us to the end of today's programme. Thank you very much to John Mitchinson and Matt Wolfe, and indeed Fernando. The show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm Andrew Muller. The Arts Review returns at the same time next week, but for now we will play out with some more of that Colombian number 1. This is X. Estamos claro y ya. No te lo voy a negar. Estamos claro.